Hello and welcome to Culture File. This is Luke Clancy with your weekly culture booster. In this week's shot, we meet the artist Marianne Keating, whose film installations are currently taking up space in Sligo and Limerick. Later on, harpist Alana Thornburg plucks and leads us on some encounters with the little people. And Tiger Sullivan has further encounters with artworks that never were, namely an unmade play not written by Michael Harding. But first, no Irish Need Apply and Uncunus are the title of works on film from Clonmel-born artist Marianne Keating. The films use archival footage with only occasional fictional clips to recount some crucial moments and places in Irish history. In No Irish Need Apply, as Marianne Keating told me, the place is England and the stories are of Irish migrants.
I think it very much kind of, it covers Ireland, you know, kind of post-independence. We didn't have the economic means to kind of support ourselves as a country, so people had to look towards migration, and gradually became, you know, it was after World War II, so the Irish were very much used as a new labouring population to kind of rebuild England, rebuild the economy of Britain after World War II. At the same time, people from other Commonwealth countries like Jamaica were coming to England as well and helping, you know, kind of driving buses, being the nurses, being the labourers. And from the perspective of the film, it looks like how, where Ireland, where through the special relationship which you still have with the United Kingdom, where we had free movement, but people from other colonies like Jamaica and Barbados didn't. And, you know, where was the difference? And was it to do with our whiteness that we got that kind of exception, and whereas other Commonwealth countries didn't? And you had people coming over on the Windrush from Jamaica at the same time. And you look at it, to me, it's all interconnected. We look at kind of contemporary Britain and 2018, when a lot of the people who came over on the Windrush, all their documentation was destroyed by the British Home Office, and then they lost their right to stay and live in and get benefits within the United Kingdom, even though they'd lived here for 40, 50 years. And what if the Irish had been put in that position at the same time? But then it also looks like at the Irish, where there was multiple different variables. People would come over and work for, you know, fathers might come over and work for extended periods of time and then return home, send money back. Other people migrated over, but also with the troubles escalating, it changed how the Irish were viewed within England. I think there was also still a lot of derogatory comments towards the Irish anyway, but I think especially with the troubles, and especially with the bombing campaign coming over to British mainland, it changed a lot about how English people saw the Irish, and it changed everything. Like, I remember friends of mine saying that, you know, whose parents would have been Irish and they would have been brought up in the 80s, that they'd go for like a pub lunch on a Sunday and their dad would tell them to speak really quietly because he didn't want anyone to hear their Irish accents. I remember coming over to England to visit like my aunt and uncle, and my dad's car, you know, being parked outside, and the next thing the police are at the door because it's a Southern Reg car parked in part of England. So all those kind of stories, to me, they're all interconnected. And I suppose the film looks at those moments and looks how the Irish community as a whole was just thrown together as one unit. I think like people that left from the 40s, 50s, 60s, even way up to the 80s, you know, it was a very different type of movement. People were very much, there wasn't the jobs, there wasn't employment, there wasn't the kind of, I suppose, the social structure to support them in any way in Ireland. For me, I could have stayed in Ireland, you know, there wasn't to the same level. But to me, it was also like you have one life, and it's to make the best of that life that you can. And I think even from my very early days moving to London, like my first Christmas, I came home, like obviously, you know, I was a student as well, right? So, and I didn't have the money behind me to, you know, kind of be flying home for Christmas, so I got the boat back, and as I had left, and it was quite like, I think that's kind of part where that kind of realization of where you live in another country. And I was got the bus from Victoria Coach Station in London, and you go to one of the ferry ports in Wales, and then you come across on the boat. And I left on Christmas Eve, and the bus was packed with people, like packed with Irish people going home. But I think two of the kind of most shocking things that to me on the bus were two elderly people who were sitting separately. And one was an elderly man, maybe in his kind of, I'd say maybe about 76, 78. And he had obviously been cleaned up by someone. So you could see he had a fresh haircut. You could see that his beard had been shaved because you could see the different color in his skin tone. And he had a nice kind of like trousers on and a nice shirt, but he had no coat or no jumper, and he had a bin bag, a black bin bag with the two arms cut out that he was wearing as a rain jacket. And the other lady who was on the bus was an elderly woman who was, I'd say, probably a similar age, maybe a little bit older, very frail, very small, had all her 80s garb on, kind of like, you know, kind of a cheap kind of leather, you know, leather coat and like the plastic earrings. And she had this kind of, you know, kind of like a small little crossbody bag that was, you know, it was had a very plastic 80s vibe to it. And she was so scared. And she was so scared to go to the toilet after when the bus stopped every couple of hours because she was afraid someone was going to steal her stuff. And straight away, you realize that I have left through one form of migration and other people have left through another. And we're all on this bus together coming back to this country for Christmas, which, you know, kind of Ireland being that Catholic state and all that it was, even though, you know, people don't necessarily follow Catholicism anymore, but Christmas is still something that's very much celebrated across the country. So, and these people are returning and very much, they were kind of polished up by the system, right? It was probably St. Vincent de Paul's or someone that kind of, you know, gave them an extra couple of bob to come home. And they're coming home to their families and they're probably telling them that everything is wonderful and it's great. And they're not speaking about the reality of what their living circumstances probably were. And within Ireland, I think there was always this history where you could possibly have a home, but you couldn't have a job. And in England, you could have a job, but you couldn't have a home. And it was this kind of very, I think from very straight away from that first moment, I was kind of hit by, oh, you're now an Irish person living in another country that's returning. And even though I chose to leave and I could leave, there was similarities with other people's stories that we were all Irish people in another country. And I think it's also for me and my friends, like a lot of my friends moved to London before the recession, and they moved with this kind of like exciting about going to London and, you know, as an exciting place to be and kind of maybe careers within creative careers. But there was also that thing that they always thought they would return. Whereas I feel like when I left, Ireland kind of forced me out and there was a different relationship. And I don't see returning in the same way as they would see. So I think there's also, and there's also the part of it where if you've left Ireland, people in Ireland think, well, you've left, right? So there's less empathy on what the struggles might be in another country because in another way, you've left, right? So, and it's also that thing with the British or the Irish government in the 80s, whereas if you left Ireland, you weren't classed as the same kind of Irish citizen anymore because you had left. And I felt that as well when I left during the recession. You know, there was very little support for the Irish people that left Ireland during the recession, that there was no kind of economic stability for us. So we left. But then because we left, you're seen in a different light too. So, yeah, it's complex. It's always complex. It's never very straightforward, I think.
I lived in England with my family, you know, up to the age of about 13. Okay. But I like my mother's constant kind of mantra was, when we go home.
Yeah.
And it was like, we moved several places in England, but there was never a notion that you'd stay here.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, there's still people, I think I imagine, that are still here that think they're still going to go home or go home at some point. And I think often within those narratives and talking to people, it's when grandkids arrive. So up to that point, they think that they're, oh, we'll still retire, you know, back to Ireland. We'll still go home. We'll go home. But then once the grandkids arrive, they realize, well, there isn't actually that much for us in Ireland. And maybe our family is actually here. And maybe this is our home. And I think sometimes it takes a long time for people to accept it. Sometimes it's easier to let it float in the possible return is easier. And it's easier for people at home to think, oh, they'll come back at some point, rather than making it so finite as it would have been centuries earlier when you left, you left. Or even in the 1920s, you know, you may never come back. If even in the 1980s when you went to the States, right?
Your work, you'll tell me if this is a phrase you're uncomfortable with, but it sort of exists in the area of documentary as art.
Yeah.
I mean, are you happy enough with that?
Like, it's not documentary, because I think in the sense that if I was making, and I think there's also the colonial way of looking at it, that in that colonial way that everything has to fit nice and neatly into a category. And if it doesn't fit nicely.
I'm all over that.
Yeah. So I think there's kind of, I see why people put me in that kind of mode. And I see where my work also leans in that way in parts. But I think to me, I think with a lot of, I suppose, looking at, there's so many different ways of making documentaries, right? But I suppose for me, the work leads where the output is going to be. So it's not predetermined. And I don't work with kind of, I'm going to tell you the story from start to finish. I'll tell you this part of it, and then I'll see how it connects to that other part. So I think there's... I understand what you're saying, but yes, at the same time, yeah. I suppose it's like I'm not trained as a filmmaker, right? So that's also part of where... So I'm approaching it very much from an artist's perspective. And I did work predominantly, I suppose, within kind of screen printed. I did large screen printed wall, floor, ceiling installations. I suppose I just don't see it as one thing or the other.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's one of the things I was thinking, like Adam Curtis is another person in the area, and yeah, as I said, Luke Fowler, that part of the practice is the work with archives, isn't it? I mean, it's finding this material in the first place to tell a story.
Yeah, and I think that's where literally the history in Jamaica kind of came about, like, because in Ireland we'd lost 95% of our records during the Civil War, right? So we didn't have a lot of our information. But within Jamaica, because of the Jamaica being a colony of Britain at the time, they had one copy in Jamaica, and if it was missing in the British archives, you could find it in Jamaica, or if it was missing in Jamaica, you could possibly find it in the National Archives in Kew. So I started to do this triangular mapping of trying to fill the narrative that was in one country's archives and histories, or what one country had seen as being as important to record from whatever perspective, whether it was like economics or, you know, kind of, because nothing is recorded for the sake of the narrative. It's recorded, you know, through the Foreign Office or whatever office it was. My interest with archives is what has been recorded or what has been allowed to be recorded within state archives and how they've been sterilized along the way.
In No Irish Need Apply, a lot of the work is contemporary media, you're finding.
Yeah.
Where do you begin that search? Is it like, is Ireland a keyword and Ireland immigration and you start off?
I suppose there's a couple of weird things. I suppose because I've been doing this kind of research for the last like 12 years, I have formed a huge body of footage as well. So, and I've kind of got used to, it's kind of my second nature, you know, kind of finding archive footage, and I have all these different sources and all these different places that I go to look for different things. And often a piece of footage might have come across it 5 years ago, and then I'm like, oh, that will help me fill that gap in the story. Sometimes I don't know where a film is going to end, or kind of I have a starting bit and I have an end, but I'm not sure where it's going to go. And sometimes the material leads me, and sometimes I lead the material, and sometimes the footage that looks like archival footage is actually my footage that's filmed in 4K but distressed to look archival, to make the audience believe, because I often believe in the sense that it's true if it's old, or, you know, black and white photograph, you know, that archival photograph is correct, but they don't believe that it could have been staged or whatever else.
It went through my mind, I was looking at, and I think this is actually not staged, it looks like it's a casual situation and it's a black and white film. I wonder, did you stage it? And it's a man who talks about the moral debt that the British owe the Irish, and how systematic abuses over the centuries had caused that, but that it continued because the Irish labourers were now providing this sort of useful workforce.
That's a real clip, and he's so articulate in that moment, isn't it? And it's literally in a pub, probably an Irish pub, after, you know, he was a labourer on a building site, I'm sure, because everyone else in the pub seemed to be labourers, and often the Irish were paid in the Irish pubs by the Irish companies, so that they were given their wages and then they straight away drank their wages and the wages went back into their hands again. And this was kind of part of an interview series that was done by a British journalist, and he was kind of looking at, you know, kind of, are they abusing the system, you know, do we need them or not? And I think he had a very kind of negative opinion towards the Irish, but yet this man kind of completely turns them on his head and he leaves them with nothing to say. And I just think also that makes me really proud as an Irish person, that someone in a pub, you know, after working a long, hard day, can also be so articulate, knowing exactly the situation they're in and how they're being exploited within that moment.
Yeah, it's such a great clip, because it throws you back onto the framing that the little news crew has done.
Yeah.
And then you realise, like, just the framing of let's go talk to some Irish people in a pub has all the power structure built into it.
Yeah, and also a lot of the kind of conversations that he had, other questions he asked, where, like, you know, the Irish being troubled, the Irish fighting, the Irish being drunk, the Irish, you know, kind of, it was all negative. He had such a stereotypical perspective of what he thought the Irish were. And you've got this man that just kind of completely obliterates him in a bar, and yeah, and he speaks the truth and he kind of calls him out, and he puts all global politics together in like a very short few sentences.
Marianne Keating there, and you can hear those short few sentences along with many more at the Model in Sligo, where No Irish Need Apply is showing until June 21st, and you can see on Cunasat Limerick City Gallery of Art until June 8th. Now, this year, in a project you wouldn't want to be too superstitious about, Tig O'Sullivan has been looking at art that never quite was, lost or abandoned works that could have been quite something if it weren't for reasons. This time, the search brings him to the door of playwright Michael Harding.
Theatre has always struck me as a deeply ephemeral art form. Compared to cinema, or indeed painting or architecture, theatre cares little for posterity, or indeed any final concrete form. Productions cannot be held in any archive, while even the performances themselves can be unique to a particular night. Coming from the carefully archived world of film, I've often wondered about this side of the creative life for those working in theatre.
I started in 1986, full-time writing. And my first success would have been a play in the Peacock called Straw Boys. And I was very high when it was on, and I was cycling around Stony Batter where I had a little house. And I was thinking, like, I have it made now, I might as well buy a house and things, you know, this is it. And then after 4 weeks, the show was over and all the posters came down, because I'd see the posters for the play at bus stops, and then they were all gone. And there was other posters up for other plays, and you'd almost resent them. Like, it was kind of, you know, they're doing other people's plays. It's not just me in the world. And then I realised, so I've gone full-time writing, got a play on in the Abbey, in the Peacock, and it's over. What do I do now for the rest of my life?
What Michael Harding did next was to become one of Ireland's most prolific and successful writers.
I realised at that stage that I had to make writing a daily practice, like that it became a meditational practice, because I'd been in religion, so writing became the exercise, like the meditation.
Dealing with the ephemerality of successful work is one thing. A certain mystique attaches even to long-gone productions. What, though, of plays that were never made? Projects that existed only in the mysterious abstract. For me, such works captured something particular in the realm of unmade art. Ghosts of ghosts. Many years ago, I heard tell of one such play, a remarkable sounding work that drew together the threads of some of my keenest historical and social interests. The 19th century tenants' revolt that was the Land League and the political machinations of the church. From what I could glean, it was a play that brought these two competing forces of Irish history together in the unlikely crucible of the apparitions at Knock.
Well, the Knock story is just, it was about Knock. And the final title of it was Knock Knock, as in the joke, but also as in the metaphysical possibility of there being more to reality than the surface, the kind of, you know, knocking on the door in Macbeth, that other forces sometimes come to us. I'd been writing clerical plays. I'd been writing Una Pucca, clerical play about the Pope. Then I did a multimedia play called Misogynist. And then I finally, it was like a trilogy. They were all done in the Abbey, and the third one was Sour Grapes. There was a story in it about a clerical boy's suicide in Maynooth because he had been abused sexually by a senior cleric. And I had more to write about clergy. But I'd heard this story that there was a really interesting dimension to the apparition at Knock. The dimension to it was that Michael Davitt was very powerful at the time. The Land League was very powerful at the time. And that the clerical church was nervous of this sweep of populism that was running through the Land League. You know, they were becoming the saviours of the world. And that was a kind of a modernity on one side. And then on the other side, there was a sort of medieval rash of magic belief, also challenging the clerical church. And in that, the theory was that the apparitions were a fake. that they were done with somebody using a kind of a projector. And so the same, you would think, would make a wonderful play. So you do a kind of a deconstructionist thing where you'd have a character in the play would be the big parish priest of Knock, sort of a dominant, you know, big bullish sort of misogynist. And his enemy would be Michael Davitt, the antagonist, you know, the secularist sort of political fellow improving people's lives. And then you'd have this dodgy character who comes from Dublin and he's having dinner with the Monsignor or whatever, and he's shown him this new fangled kaleidoscope, magic lanterns, I think they were called, you know, and the parish priest is saying to himself, good, if I had that now and threw up a little image on the wall outside, I might control the people better. That was the conceit of the play. And of course, the journey of the play was that somebody would be exposing this fake, the apparition as a fake. And then you evolve it with the different characters to the very moment where they're concocting the fakeness and they realise it's not fake because we're not doing this. The apparition is coming from somewhere else. It's not a fake. And that's what you're not expecting. But you weren't expecting.
No.
That's the trick.
Because that's what you felt, or because for pure dramatic reasons?
I think for dramatic reasons, but also because obviously everything that you feel, you imbue into a play. I had done three plays which were very kind of deconstructionist of the whole institutional thing. And I'd say I was coming to a point of faith where I wanted to try and find some technical way to a... The great Peter Brook, his great line is, theatre is about making the invisible visible. We want to see the invisible. We want God to manifest.
It sounds like a brilliant play.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a good play.
And what happened?
Nobody was interested. I think that they had had enough of me doing plays about clerics. So that was the end of it. Like, I began to change at that stage. Once that happened, it was about the late 90s, and I started doing my own one-man shows, I began to realise that I could integrate more and more rather than putting the package together as a play and presenting it to a theatre. I realised, well, you could do it yourself. The more rejections you get, the better. The more failures you have, the better. Because it funnels everything into what is your most important work, and your most important work is your next work. I would say that I've achieved more through failure than success.
How so?
Well, it's a way of looking at the world, you know? Like, your life will fail eventually. Like, I'm now 70, and I can't walk as well as I could when I was 20. Everything deteriorates. So that's a kind of failure. What I'm saying is that it is our nature to be failures. It is graceful and beautiful to realise that you don't sing so well. It's just another little note in the big orchestra of human endeavour.
Tyga O'Sullivan there in the company of playwright Michael Harding. And finally, this time, some harp and some fairy folk. Alana Thornburg's narrative music feeds from Irish mythology and folk tales, particularly stories of her own patch in County Mayo, as she told Culture File's Louise Scully.
My name is Alana Thornburg, and I am a harpist and composer from County Mayo. Growing up in Mayo, I lived in the countryside, and I would have started learning music at the age of five. I started learning the tin whistle, like many kids in Ireland, and then I started learning the fiddle, piano and the harp then at the age of 11. Both my parents are musicians, and my family as well, so we're kind of like a family band. I was also involved in cultist branches, so I was part of a ceilidh band, so like the summer was always very busy with the flas on and different festivals. So when I started travelling to America with my family first, I was five at the earliest. My dad grew up in Virginia near like Baltimore and DC, so he had a lot of friends there from the Irish music scene, so we would have played the circuit around there. There was always a harp in my house because my mum played the harp. And I was always quite fascinated by it. And just as a child, I'd be going over to it and plucking a string or two. Then there was an opportunity when I was 11. There was like a summer school nearby. They were taking on harp students as beginners. That's kind of like not... It's quite unusual to have like a beginner's class. So I signed up for it, and then the rest is history. We formed a band called Alfie in 2017. So it was myself and my two friends, Fiacre Meek and Ryan McCauley. Ryan's a five-string clawhammer banjo player, and Fiacre plays the pipes, and I play the harp. So we play like a mix of traditional Irish music and Appalachian old-time American music and song. So I released my debut album, Shapeshifter. It's a collection of original compositions inspired by fairy folklore and mythology in rural Ireland, specifically County Mayo, where I'm from. I interviewed close to 50 people about their like experience of fairy folklore and mythology, gathering different stories from people. It was mainly like family members or historians, storytellers, or just local characters. Like every town has a character. So I'd gather these stories, and then a lot of them kind of had the similar theme. So then I'd compose a piece of music in response. So that's how Shapeshifter came about. And the name itself comes from, well, a lot of the stories in fairy folklore and mythology are related to shapeshifters. For example, the fairy folk themselves are shapeshifters, and a common form that they can take on is that of a like monstrous black fairy dog, which is quite scary. And then another common myth in Celtic mythology is that hares, the animals, are shapeshifters and that they can take on the form of a woman. I knew that I wanted to interview my granddad, first of all. He lived beside us in rural County Mayo, and there was a huge fairy fort, or there is a huge fairy fort, behind his house. So I knew that he'd have a story or two to tell, and I was right. He told me the story of Mick na Mreig, which means Mick the Liar. That's a track on the album. He noticed one day that his sheep were going missing, so he decided to inspect and see what was going on. And the sheep were wandering into the fairy fort, the same fairy fort that is behind mine and my granddad's house. And they were falling in, they weren't able to get back up, so they were starving and dying. So he decided to take matters into his own hands, and he rolled a big stone in front of the entrance of the fairy fort. But you're not supposed to damage or touch or go near the fairy fort, disturb them in any way. So the next day he woke up paralysed and was bedbound for the rest of his life. So nice spooky one there for you. We were warned really never to go near it. It's very close to where his house is, so within walking distance, like you can see it, it's huge as well. We would have wandered up towards it as kids, but we never stepped inside, just out of fear. We would have been very curious about it and like wandered up towards it, but we never went inside. Actually, that's wrong. One of my cousins did go inside once, and he broke a branch, and we were teasing him that the fairies would be after him, but so far he's okay.
Alana Thornburg there, and the reporter was Louis Scully. The album Shapeshifters is available from Bandcamp and alanathornburg.com for tour dates. That's all for this time. Culturefile will be back with a special programme on Caravaggio next time. Till then, bye now.